First, some Oregon well water before we start.
Oh, that's good. All right, well, thanks very much for being here this afternoon. Our first speaker is me. I'm Blair Bobier. I was the media director for the Green Party's 2004 presidential campaign. For those of you who got to see David Cobb down here, you can understand what a thrill that was. David's a lot of fun. I'd like to start off talking about media with a little story that happened right here in the Rose City. About 15 years ago or so, we were getting the Green Party on the ballot here in Oregon. We were known as the Pacific Party at the time. And there was a publication in town called PDXS. It had just started up. It was trying to be a hipper-than-now alternative publication. And a colleague of mine, who we'll call Joe Smith for purposes of this story, wanted to get into PDXS issues about the Green Party and how this new publication basically stood for everything that we stood for, and they should be simpatico, they should be colleagues, they should be comrades in arms. So he wrote a letter to PDXS, and he couldn't wait to see until it was published. So I think they published on Thursday, and Wednesday night, if you went out, you could maybe get a real early copy. Went to a local watering hole, populated by a lot of activists. There were stacks of papers. He picked up stacks, passed them out to all his friends. He opened up PDXS, and they had their editorials on the inside page. And there it said, "We got a letter this week from a guy named Joe Smith. Joe Smith thinks that the Pacific Party is the answer to all our problems here in Oregon and the world." And then they went on for the balance of the editorial to basically rip Joe Smith a new orifice. They concluded the editorial by saying, "Get this straight, Joe. The media doesn't work for you. And the sooner you learn this lesson, the better off you'll be." Well, it kind of reminds me of the Mark Twain line back in the days when it was all print, that you don't want to start arguments with people who buy barrels of ink. Fundamental problem in the media today is it's big business. Six companies basically own almost all the media outlets in this country. So for all intents and purposes, there's six CEOs, six white guys, who are deciding everything that you see, read, everything on the radio, television, film. Used to be there were a number of daily newspapers in each town. Now there's usually one. There used to be labor newspapers. There used to be newspapers owned by families, and now it's all corporate controlled, and there's usually one paper in each town. I think the idea of the media these days, the corporate media, I don't like using the term mainstream media because I think we're the mainstream and I think they're corporations, so I like to use the term corporate press. Corporate press wants to keep us in the dark, basically, you know, kind of barefoot pregnant in the kitchen. I think they learned their lesson in Vietnam. They don't want to see images of body bags and coffins coming home from Iraq. They are limiting the coverage of corpses that you see from New Orleans. So we're not getting the story from the corporate press. Even just look at your newspapers, and I hope you argue with your daily newspapers. Look at their headlines and what they're composed of. Do they talk about the 46 million people who are uninsured in this country that don't have health insurance? Do they talk about the pollution that's running rampant? Do they talk about how solar and wind power could be readily replacing our current sources of energy and pollution? No. You know, and look at the headlines. If you're someplace where there's a bunch of news boxes, and if you see your local newspaper, the big newspaper in your state, the New York Times, maybe USA Today, same headline, same headline, same headline, same headline, you will think this way, you will think this way, you will think this way. Okay, well, I just wanted to frame the discussion here a little bit to talk about our experiences in dealing with the vote in Ohio and the Ohio recount. I don't know if you're aware of this, because if you read the mainstream corporate press, you wouldn't be seeing this, but David Cobb, the Green Party, along with Michael Badnarik, the Libertarian presidential candidate, requested recounts in Ohio, New Mexico, and Nevada. And basically, we were challenged and thwarted in each one of those places. We pulled out our request in Nevada after they demanded, I think it was $346,000 at the last minute, and demanded that we give them a list of the numbers of the voting machines that we wanted to have audited, even though they have the numbers. In New Mexico, though state law very clearly says that we had to put up about $110,000 for a deposit, they decided to charge us over $1 million. And we decided we weren't going to pay them $1 million. We took them to court. That case has made its way up to the New Mexico Supreme Court. It was argued there recently, and when we get a decision, we'll see how that turns out. In Ohio, we initiated a recount. We actually got one. Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell in Ohio, who was the co-chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign, didn't start the recount until the day that the Electoral College met. So that didn't exactly do us a lot of good. Once they had finally finished conducting the recount, it was basically done improperly in just about every county. There has to be a random sampling of precincts done. In 86 of the 88 counties, the random sampling was not done randomly. There are all sorts of problems with the Ohio recount. There was a lack of standards, a lack of security, access to voting machines, allegations of tampering with voting machines. One county elections office was left open for the entire weekend prior to the recount. In another, there were ballots strewn about with pop cans and bags of chips. I had said at the time that I thought the Three Stooges were in charge of security for the Ohio recount. That's kind of all a lead up to what happened and how we actually got the Ohio recount conducted and how we got the word spread out through the activist community, through the grassroots, and how we managed to have one of the very few rare Electoral College vote challenges in the history of our country. And all that came about because of grassroots media. When we decided to demand a recount in Ohio, we were broke. We were a third-party campaign that ran a national presidential campaign on what some people spend for city council races. And believe me, come November, we were broke. We were thinking about initiating a recount, and word got out on KPFK in LA, Pacific affiliate, that we were going to announce that we would seek a recount, and we started being flooded with phone calls and email messages from people wanting to help us get the recount going. So in about 4 days, we raised over $100,000, which was pretty darn close to what we had raised and spent during the remainder of our campaign. It happened on community radio. It happened through an excellent website that we had revamped specifically for the recount, and that's still up at VoteCobb, VoteCobb.org. There were a couple of commercial stations that carried our message, but not many. There were internet alternative outlets, Raw Story, Truth Out, and just email, just people grassroots organizing. I mean, it was really astounding how this turned out. We organized thousands of volunteers and donors through the internet. Now, I think we really have to look at how incredible this is, because there really was not a national power structure that was behind this. The major voting rights organizations in this country weren't behind it. There were some that were, National Voting Rights Institute, I think Common Cause came out in favor of it, Alliance for Democracy did, but this was something that we organized, and largely through grassroots activism and the net. At one point, just before the January 6th challenge, I spoke to John Bonifaz, our counsel, who said, you know, we really need to get more pressure on Barbara Boxer. I think that she could be persuaded to stand up. But, you know, so if you know people in California, and I was back in D.C. at the time with a rusty old laptop, and I didn't have very many addresses with me, so I sent out an email message saying, here's Barbara Boxer's fax number and phone number and all her contact information. I sent it to a couple of people, had no idea what would happen with it. A little while later, I got a message back from someone saying, your message was forwarded to me. I have this list in California of 5,000 or so email addresses. Your message went out. So the Ohio recount, the January 6th Electoral College vote challenge, demonstrate the power of the grassroots and alternative media. We did that. You didn't read about it in the Washington Post, except for a little thing like this. You didn't read about it in the New York Times, except until after the fact. It's something that we did. After January 6th, there began, as this is part of a series of them, there began a series of teach-ins, of forums and conferences on voting rights. As Penny Little and other folks have done, there have been fantastic videos and fantastic film work done of this. If you haven't seen the election protection video. It's up at our VoteCob website that shows Election Day in Columbus, Ohio, and showing hundreds of people, mostly African Americans, waiting hours in the rain to cast their ballots. You haven't seen the real story. It's something, again, you're not seeing on the network news. I have to say, from my experience in working with the corporate press, my note down here just for my outline says, didn't know they're asked from their elbow. Of course, I wouldn't say that in a family setting like this, but I think that a lot of reporters are very well-intentioned, and I went to journalism school during the Woodward and Bernstein craze. I very much believe in the power of the press, and so I would treat reporters with incredible reverence, and then I'd meet them and find out that they're 20 years younger than I am, and that maybe they're doing this because they can't get a job somewhere else. It's not entirely fair. There's a lot of very good, well-trained reporters and editors out there, but when I had to explain to the Washington Post reporter for the second or third time the process that was going to happen on January 6th, I started scratching my head. There were other problems as well. Once something gets out in the corporate press, truth, lie, somewhere in between, it's subject to what I call amplification. There was an AP story that went out after we had busted our chops to get the recount going, and most notably, we got the recount going because someone else didn't. There was someone who lost the vote by a relatively narrow margin in Ohio who would likely be president of the United States if he stood up for himself and his party, and most importantly, stood up for the people who waited hours in line to vote for him in the rain. He did not. We wound up, the Cobb campaign, the Green Party, wound up having to initiate the recount in Ohio. And when I saw a story one day with an AP tagline about how Kerry was pushing the recount in Ohio, I was livid. And I called up the reporter and I called up editors and they're, sorry about that. But, it got out there and then you have to combat that. And it's not the only time that it happens. And for those of you who have been activists and have worked on campaigns or have gone to demonstrations, you go to a demonstration and there's hundreds and hundreds of people, maybe there's thousands of people, and then the press writes, 30 people showed up to protest policies about. So, where do we go with this? Well, there's different elements. One is to be the media. I think that's Jello Biafra's rallying cry and something that Penny and other folks have done. Brad from the Brad blog is going to be here, and I think there's really something to be said for being the media. Remember the story at the beginning. If you're going to write a letter to someone else's paper or try to get an article in, they frame it any way they want to. They cut what they want to. They put it. You can write something incredibly serious, and they'll put an idiotic headline over it. So being the media, controlling our message, I think is really one of the ways that we have to go. We have the technology. We have web. We can have webcasts. We can have low-power FM radio. And in fact, right now, there's a Green Party member in Louisiana that is working to get a low-power FM station up in New Orleans because there's no stations broadcasting there now. I have to say that I don't think we should over-rely on technology because nothing replaces human-to-human contact. I think teach-ins are very important. I don't think we should ever stop knocking on doors and talking to our neighbors and our family about things that are important. Remember the Boston Tea Party. Paul Revere, all these kind of things. There are good things that our founding fathers and mothers did, and I think grassroots activism is at that core. So I look at it in two different ways, and one is, how do you reach people in the choir, that's us, and organize the choir, and then how do we go beyond the choir? I heard the great environmentalist David Brower talk one day and said that they had some type of environmental fair in the Bay Area. And they got, a few hundred people, maybe 1,000 or so. He said the Grateful Dead were on the other side of the bay, and they had 20,000 people. He said, I want to do what they're doing. And I think that's really our challenge. I'm really thankful that you folks came out, and I think we'll get the message out further and further through cable and media. But where's the other 20,000 people? Why do people show up for football games, basketball games, and not show up to preserve our democracy? I think there's a real fundamental problem. And that's something that we have to do. And I don't think we can just, say, gee, those guys are at football. I think we have to have our own events like that. I think we have to do things that are stimulating and fun and entertaining. I heard a great line on PBS the other night, the only television station I get out in the boonies. I think it was the History of Protest Music, where they said, you can write pamphlets people maybe read it once, but if you put a good song together, people will sing them forever. So, you know, we have to sing our revolution. And I think it's real important how we frame things and how we reach people. There's a certain way we can talk to each other, but when we're going to go out and talk to neighbors, when we're going to talk to people who are Republicans, who we need to work with, you have to think of how to frame things. One colleague points out a sugar pile. And if you want to move a whole sugar pile, you don't do it just by grabbing the little bits at the edge. You got to go right for the middle. And we need that language. We need those issues and approaches that are going to grab as many people and bring them with us. There's a number of different ways to work with the media, and there's some things to keep in mind. I don't think we should discount the corporate media because they have such the distribution, because they reach people, and they reach people that we want to reach. Just the other day, I got a little announcement in my hometown paper, the Corvallis Gazette Times, that I had submitted about this conference. And they printed it almost word for word. They changed about three words in it. And the way you do that to get things into your local paper or the daily is to be very objective, very straightforward, write it like a news piece, don't use superlatives. And they put it right in there with a little byline that said, by the Gazette Times, which was fine. I got the word out about the voting conference and about the people who were speaking here, a little shameless self-promotion on my part, but it worked. If you're going to do that, you have to be reliable, you have to be balanced, and then there's the other side of the coin where that only gets you so far, and if you want to be the story, if you want to be in the story, you need to be a little outrageous. And I think you know that you know, we can have teach-ins and conferences and panels, but if somebody walked on stilts through downtown Portland juggling fire, that's much more likely to get on the 6 o'clock news. So again, we have to think of how we can really be creative and get our message out there. I have found that small town papers are very hungry for news, and that when we did our Green Party presidential campaign, the small town papers gave us great press. Whenever David Cobb and Pat LaMarche, our vice presidential candidate, showed up places, they got interviewed, they were often on the front page. So don't overlook the small town papers, they're very eager. Of course, there's alternative weeklies. A lot of them now are big business, and so that can kind of cut either ways, but there's weeklies in every place. Local radio often needs people to be on air. They have a lot of air time to fill. College papers, indie media, and I think the whole approach is to just make sure that you have someone who can use the medium that's there. Do you have someone who can write? Put them in touch with the paper. Do you have someone who speaks well? Maybe they're good on radio. Do you have someone who can be very flashy and dynamic? Sounds like your TV person. Have the right person for the right medium, and then just develop those connections. Sometimes it really takes a while. You have to know who to talk to. You can't just call up a newspaper and say, I've got a great idea for you. Who's the reporter that covers that beat? If you're doing voting stuff, who's the one that covers the State House? Who covers City Hall? Find these people. Call them up. Say, hi, I work with this nonprofit organization. We've got X number of members. We're real interested in this. We live here in the community. You want to have a beer and buy a cup of coffee? And start developing those contacts. Become a source. Become credible, and the media will go to you. So there's a lot of different ways to get in the papers. Letters to the editor are one of the most frequently read parts of the paper. Op-eds, the opinion pages, they usually run between 500 and 750 words. They put guidelines in each paper. They're on the website, the instructions for how to get in. They're open. Use them. Sometimes finding someone who's more famous or more credible than we are and having a joint byline. Is there someone who's a local activist or an author, academic? Say, hey, can we write a piece together and put it in under our byline together? You know, that works a lot, too. We have to educate people. Going back to the Post reporter that I talked to, these reporters are generalists very often. Very few of them have political science backgrounds. Just out of curiosity, how many people in this room know about instant runoff voting? Just raise your hand if you... Okay, pretty educated group. If you go out and talk to newspaper reporters, you're not going to find the same percentage of people who know what we know. So you can't just assume that they know about instant runoff voting. You've got to take them out for coffee or a beer and educate them. Give them something that's short and pithy to read. Copy something off the web. Send them an email. Show up at their office and drop something on their desk. Find little pamphlets that have good graphics, something that they can digest readily. Think about yourself. If someone came to you with a 30-page report of fine print, would you want to read that? I'm like George Bush. Just give me the bottom line. Tell me what I need to know. And I think that works for people. And it takes time. We got a great piece in The Nation about the Cobb campaign. And William Grider, one of the greatest authors, I think, out there today, wrote the piece. And that took months, probably longer than months, because I started communicating with him years ago on related subjects. And so that finally, when I was in a position where I was representing the Green Party's presidential campaign, I knew him. I at least had his phone number. And I said, hey, you should really cover this guy. And I knew that The Nation was interested in it. And it turned out that Bill Grider wrote a very complimentary piece about David Cobb and the Green Party. I think it really established us as an independent entity that we are, somewhat helped take us out of Ralph Nader's shadow, and established the party and its platform as being really unique and really different. So you can be the contact, you can be the source, you can be the media, and don't let go. Follow up, monitor. Whenever something comes out in the press that is within your area of expertise, call up that reporter. Compliment them. Man, that was a great piece you wrote. That was really good. You really got it right on. When they come up with a glaring error, contact them. I really appreciate the work you do. Thanks for getting this out there. By the way, I'd like to point this out to you, that this statement was incorrect. This was inaccurate. Here's where you can find proof of that. So I think the whole thing is just to treat our friends in the corporate press as friends, as allies, and educate them, cultivate them, bring them along, and be the media. I think we're going to hear from Penny in just a moment. And what I'd like to do after we hear Penny's presentation is hear from you folks, and not just questions of us as presenters, but I would love to hear what your ideas are for using alternative media and for getting our ideas out there and how we can keep this going. So I just want to conclude by saying that what has happened since the Ohio recount, in my mind, has been the emergence of what we call the new voting rights movement. And it has really been driven by the grassroots. There's nobody doing this but us. And we're doing it with our own media, we're doing it with our own money, we're doing it with our own people, and we're doing it with people like you in the room. So I really think that you should take a moment and applaud yourselves for being here and for taking on this very important task, because without the right to vote, all our other rights are going to prove to be meaningless. So we have to protect the right to vote. It's up to all of us, and we have proven that we can do it successfully. Thank you.
Thank you, Blair. Thank you, whoever's removing his name. Yes, if you want to be the media, I think you have to have lots of different hats on. Filming, projecting, learning different skills. I'm going to start. I'll pass these out a little later. With a little clip from my film, Electile Dysfunction. And we all know there's a lot of electoral dysfunction in this country. I know that you know that I know. So just a tiny, tiny clip that deals with the media. Thank you.
soundbite that the media used to assassinate the character of Howard Dean. You don't even get to hear her speeches by people, and you're supposed to decide the fate of your country based on these out-of-context soundbites.
You can see already what's happening in Boston. The networks were there. They had all their technology there. They had all the journalists there. They just didn't go on the air. They didn't broadcast it on the grounds that it wasn't newsworthy.
I interviewed, turned on the camera and sent my colleagues in Florida, my BBC cameras, interviewed a Fox News reporter this year. And I said, why don't you cover this stuff? She said, it was unpatriotic. No questions asked. No news out there. Basically, silence is patriotism.
Please speak,
is the media doing its job in covering the political culture in the way that we should have the national conversation that one expects the media to stimulate? And to start the conversation, because you don't know what all the questions are until you start looking.
And we find that those questions lead us beyond voting machines to who controls the technology and elections, and the reasons for wanting to do so.
Anna Luhema was supposed to have said, when she was kicked off the plantation in Mississippi, Bannaloo, why do you want the right to vote? It don't mean nothing. And she was reported to have said, it must mean something. You all are doing it.
If you got a better place to be, you can stay at home and watch TV. You can be kicking it with your crew. Let the billionaires choose for you.
Only 50% of the people vote because they're tuned out. They're not turned on by the coverage. The coverage, in fact, pushes them out of the system rather than includes them in it and involves them in it.
The other reason could be that they're smart enough to know that they don't have a stake in the election. They've made their vote, they're voting with their feet.
It's just like if you tell a child, we're going to have a big birthday party for you, and then they come out and there's no birthday party, well, they're not going to keep coming out.
Dr. King said we shall overcome. We're without the right to vote. Can we express ourselves? It's not a complete democracy, it's a democratic republic, but we must vote. Because every vote counts. Not just your vote, my vote, everybody's vote counts. They left me.
If everybody votes, there was the ultimate vote, and they can make a revolving door out of Washington, D.C.
And now, an important election day announcement.
Now, just a short clip, but he... Hold on a second. So, when January 6th happened, how many of our U.S. citizens actually knew what historic event occurred? It was the first time since 1877 that Congress challenged the vote. And if you were watching C-SPAN or got that tiny little clip, well, where they're talking over Barbara Boxer, you maybe knew a little bit about it. And why did the Democrats, who challenged the vote, supposedly challenged this certification, say they didn't expect it to change anything? And it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And how many knew of the statistically impossible discrepancies between the exit polls and the official vote counts? And rather than demand an investigation, our citizens seem to be eager to just put the election behind them, get over it, no sore loser man here. And if you didn't hear it on Fox, CNN, or the New York Times, will you believe it? Only Keith Olbermann seemed to be the voice in the wilderness, and of course the Internet. And it seemed like it was a media blackout. And you, again, you know that I know, we're preaching to the choir, but I think about the choir a lot. And one of the things I think, because I'm a musician and a filmmaker, I think that we've got to teach the choir to sing. And we've got to teach the choir to sing so loud they can be spilled out over the church walls until the people in the street hear it. And so here I am, you know, preaching to the choir. But what we're doing here today is building community. And we're building our faith and our hope, because this isn't just a church of platitude. This is the church of what are we going to do now? I mean, I can go to platitudes. I love be the media. Become the media. And, you know, I deal with this on a daily basis, and I deal with all of the obstacles and the minefields of becoming the media, because there are minefields. And one of the things I love that Bev Harris says is that if you just do one thing, that one thing, it'll teach you what to do next. So we've got to start by beginning. And I also think about platitudes, you know, because we've got to take back America. We've got to take back our religion. We've got to take back the media. But for me, that's a little negative. I really think we don't have to take back anything because it's ours. It's already ours. We just have to change our attitude a little bit and stop thinking in terms of lack. It's we the people, we the sovereign, not them the sovereign, and we the subjects. And I want to show some examples today of some positive things, and I'm going to talk about some negative things, too, because I keep facing these minefields. So one of the things, my dear friend Barbara Trent, she's the Academy Award-winning filmmaker who did Panama Deception, we put on a media summit last year as part of the Boston Social Forum, and she couldn't make it, but she gave me a statement to read. And here is Barbara Trent's statement from last year's Boston Media Summit. We need to take our rightful positions, not think of ourselves as nipping at the pants leg of power, not think of the resources allotted to our work as inadequate. It is a mindset change in which we will find ourselves helping each other out for the sake of the system, for the whole, not seeing ourselves as competitors, but rather colleagues working on different parts of the same grand scheme. People who see our films will want to see what else is out there. People who see yours will want to see yours, ours. We must create our distribution model so that it perpetuates cross-fertilization and marketing, so that everything we do maximizes everything everyone else is doing. Why not advertise each other's work at the end of our videos? Why not promote similar work when we do a TV show? Why not bring someone short along for the ride when we have a theatrical release? Why not? If we are the only voice in the wilderness, we will never be heard. Our refusal to see that makes me very sad. We are so interdependent, and we need to honor that. I brought along an example from Waging Peace, which is a film that I worked on. Just one small example of how we're doing this. A group of us are getting together, filmmakers, and putting our trailers on each other's trailers, films, and we're getting a website together so that if someone buys my movie, they can find out how to buy other movies in a similar vein. So simple. So here I have to go deal with technology for a second. Just to let you know, this is the movie, and all of these are different extras. And extras are the wonder of DVDs, because you can put all kinds of stuff on there. And I'm going to show something that was done by, actually, a student. And it's not necessarily about education, election reform, but I just really like this piece.
In the information age, life is lived in real time. Technology is the upper hand. The capabilities of U.S. spy satellites are highly classified, but they are believed to be capable of 0.1 meter resolution or approximately 3 inches. Moderate resolution imaging spectral radio mapping, wideband spread spectrum, LPI, remote sensing, spectral band, near infrared, electronic beam sensing. cell phone conversations classified. We see in ones and zeros, multispectral imaging can penetrate dense cloud cover, frequencies. Someone is always watching. Predator unmanned drones provide a low-risk alternative when violating an enemy's airspace. Data analysis. Smart communities. Night vision equipment. The sophisticated system is best capable of seeing a man tying his shoelaces. What do you see? Near infrared. What do you hear? Frequencies. What are you looking for? Spectral bands. What do you not classify?
Just an example of there's just so much content, there's so much out there, and how do we get it distributed? And so that's one of the questions that came up over and over again at the media summit. And one of the things that we thought was perhaps we need to figure that out, and perhaps we need to learn how to market like they do, and perhaps we need to like get foundation money, and we need to start really looking at all the different ways we can support each other. And I feel like we live in a new world with new technology, but we're living in an old world order. And if we come from the position of every man for themselves rather than every person for the greater good, we get into that mentality of taking, and what we're replacing it with is might even look just the same. I think we need to reclaim our intent and our purpose rather than grabbing and taking so that there is enough oxygen to go around. I've heard people say, oh, Michael Moore's taking up all the oxygen, Amy Goodman's taking all the space. No, they are forging new ground. And there's enough oxygen if people start thinking in terms of their craft, finding and creating what you can locally, and create those pockets of excellence. Work with people who have your skill set. If we really want to be the media, I get to hear a lot of people's stories because I go around the country interviewing people. And I interviewed a legislative assistant the other day who accused one of my favorite authors and activists as being an elitist. Now, I just want to talk very briefly about what are we doing accusing each other of being anything like that? You know, what is it with this circular firing squad? And, you know, whether it's left or right, middle or center, we cannot afford to let this happen. We're dealing with a giant. You know, like we're doing our protests, we're doing our forums, we come here, we get our religion. You know, but if we're jumping up and down on the arm of the giant, what are we doing? No, we got to jump on his eyeballs. You know, we got to start thinking more strategically. And I'm back to the idea again of we can't do that unless we stop being every man for himself. And that's one of my big things. So one of the things that I'm doing, too, is working with other filmmakers in the same course. We created a house party DVD. And this house party DVD has a little bit of somebody's film, a little bit of Votergate, a little bit of Linda Briquette's film, and a little bit of Erectile Dysfunction. And in so doing, we're getting, it's like the best of. It's like a compilation album. And and it's a way for people to get the information out. It's not like we have to compete against each other. And let's see, where are we? Another thing I often think about is why are even progressives willing to dismiss the crimes that have been undermining our democracy? What is going on in the collective psyche of the American public? You know, what is being done to the people, and why do they allow it? And I think there's an article by Diane Perlman, and she mentions a litany of reasons, and I'm just going to read her litany here. Conformity, herd mentality, learned helplessness, cowardice, denial, psychic numbing, submission to authority, political egocentrism, avoidance, compartmentalization, depression, all leading to a spiral of silence. Now, Elizabeth Neumann, I don't know if that's how you pronounce her name, talks about this spiral of silence. We tend to conceal our preferences when we believe we are in the minority. That's why our community building is so important, and that action is the cure to this depression. Action is the cure to erectile dysfunction, and it's the cure to mass distraction. Let's see, I have a couple more little tiny clips I want to show. Okay. I'll show a tiny clip from the... Oh, I did that again. I hate myself.
Not allowed to do that.
Here we go. You have to hold the standby down until it gives up.
It can be solved to some extent by getting certain types of legislation, such as a federal right to vote and an equal protection on a federal level, because that can be used on state lawsuits. But it will always be circumvented if you have local corruption, because that's the network that enables a larger scale of tampering or a larger scale of complete befuddlement and incompetence.
Anyone who is interested in the sanctity of the ballot, you know, Republican, Democrat, whatever party, should want to pay attention to this.
Well, I'm a big supporter of Rush Holt's bill in the House of Representatives calling for a mandatory voter verifiable paper trails and open source code.
There isn't a business person in America that wouldn't have a backup system for their computer system or for their accounting system, and that's what we're asking for our voting system.
That bill is supported by majorities in the House and the Senate. Ask the leadership, why will they not allow Rush Holt's bill to prevent ballot fraud to come to a vote?
In the United States Senate today, the Republican Party is in charge. Bill Frist can call up any bill he wants. That's the power, and he won't bring up the voting bill.
Senator Ensign's bill is probably the shortest of all of the bills, and it's focused strictly on the requirement of a voter verifiable paper record.
The people who think that a voter verified paper trail is the solution to every problem with electronic voting are completely mistaken.
electronic voting has so many complex problems that need to be dealt with that one piece of equipment is not going to solve it.
The solution is to have a system that prints a ballot, and then the ballot is counted by other means. There was a system designed by some computer scientists in Northern California, and their idea was you put a barcode on the receipt that's printed, then you go to a separate machine that verifies that the barcode is what it says it is, and then that barcoded piece of paper is counted by another system. It prints a ballot, and it does not do the tally.
You need to have good technology, and you need to have good procedures. In the end, I really think you want an independent commission.
Voter verified paper trail, open source software, a commitment to openness on the part of government officials handling the election, and a commitment to auditing and knowing which human being did what during the election, then you have honest elections.
There's lots of solutions to the problems. We have to have Election Day be a national holiday. We have to have same-day voter registration. We have to have public financing of campaigns. People who run for office should have free access to the public airwaves. We need to have, obviously, paper ballots for our machines so we can trust the machines we vote on. We have to have nonpartisan people who administer our elections. We have to have more choices, like instant runoff voting, proportional representation, like they have in most democracies in the world.
Different people have different strengths, and they like to do different things. And so if you choose something and you think, I can do that one thing, what you'll find is that when you do that one thing, you acquire more knowledge, you meet more people, and the next thing becomes apparent. So the first thing is do something,
because there are honest people on both sides of the aisle. We're not going to fix this until it's a bipartisan effort among the honest people.
We can't leave it to the media. We can't leave it to the opinion leaders. We can't leave it to the Democratic Party. It's going to be the people who are working hard on this issue who care that much about their country.
We can live with winning and losing. We cannot live with Ford and Stevens.
We are reminded of the words of Mohandas Gandhi, and they're worth repeating here today. First, they ignore us. Then they laugh at us. Then they fight us. And then we win.
So I'm probably going to turn it over to you all in a second. I just wanted to say one more thing. My mother's generation dealt with Tupperware parties, right? Well, the Tupperization of America. I saw a documentary on it once. And I think that's what we got to do, is like our own version of the Tupperization of America with our film showings, with our information, with the things we're doing. Get infomercials out. Infomercial time is not that expensive to buy. You can put on television shows. We have all this content. We can get this stuff out there. We just have to sort of get strategic and start writing the grants and start doing the work. I mean, I write grants to continue to do films. But we need larger. We need foundation money. We need to start really finding our way to get this kind of stuff out there. There's lots of people doing this. We just got to hear from them. And what about turning this over to Blair again, and some Q&A for either of us or both of us, so you have plenty of time for input on your ideas into some of the things that we can do as independent media. All right, thank you.
Libraries.
Yes, there are lots of local libraries in America still, even though their funding keeps getting cut. I'm sure that's a great idea. I wish we should be, I feel like I should be writing these down. Hold on a second.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like you guys need to get together, and I'm really happy to hear that Flying Focus Video is alive and well, because I worked with folks from there years ago. In the back?
There are quite a few, yes. You said something. Do you know of them? Can you mention them by name?
Yeah, let me mention one. Gary Beckwith put together the Solar Box Election and Justice Center early on, and is still on the desk and very informed about what other groups are doing. And Gary took the initiative of putting this CD together, which is called Election 2004 Truth, and he's distributed it for free. It's got 690 megabytes of data, including 3.5 hours of video, many littles is on it, as well as many others that you've seen clips of right here today.
So what's the website address?
Solarbus.org.
If you look up solarbus.org or Election Justice Center, either of those phrases will lead you to it.
The question was, are there websites that are putting this stuff together? And one is solarbus.org. In the interim, you can still go to votecobb.org. And at our website, we have the entire Conyers report on what went wrong in Ohio. And we also have Linda Burkett's video, Video the Vote. Is streamed there. And there's a number of groups working on this now. Global Exchange has a website. I think is it votejustice.org? But if you go to Global Exchange and look up their democracy link, Liberty Tree Foundation for the Democratic Revolution is working on some of this stuff. We do not concede, let me try that again, is another organization. And if you start going to some of these, you will find links to other organizations, and pretty soon you will find all the ones that you need, and you'll start running out of them when you see all the ones that you need. Back to you.
He's got a stack. I wanted to actually tell you about that.
I'm
carrying them. I've got 144 of them to hand out free.
Great.
Yay.
Let me tell you a little bit about how this came about. Gary has been doing this, and he's just putting it out on his website with his own mailing list. In Alameda, California, we recently had an event where we had a film collage fest with 10 U.S. films and Got Democracy and Voter Date and all these wonderful films. And then we had Las Vegas tour and Ben Harris. Mm-hmm. And we did this community event in the theater that was donated to us by a sympathetic donor. And we printed 500 of these CDs to distribute to the crowd. And by mistake, the company who printed it shipped 500 of our order to Virginia. So they came back half price. And we raised the money to buy another 500. And Gary got enough to give everybody here a free CD.
Let's hear it for Gary.
Yay, Gary.
All right.
I wanted to also say that with every DVD that I ship out How to Organize an Election Reform Teach-In. And if anyone's interested, you should take this. Laura Schaefer from the Open Voting Consortium has been working tirelessly on this issue and has organized lots of the things, including the Bob Petraeus tour, one of them. And so you should have a copy of this if you're interested, because it tells you logistical details, getting the press, getting the sound system, getting a projector.
I'll take one of those.
Yes, I'll take one of those, yes. So come on up and get one of these, you know.
There's a couple of minutes left, so...
Wait till the questions are over.
If there's any other questions, what's your question?
Actually, you asked at the beginning, how did this what we're doing?
Yes, please.
And one of the things that I think has been missing from a lot of the media
Can you stand up so folks can hear you, if you don't mind? Come on up.
One of the things that's been missing from a lot of the media that's been captured, and we've spoken of the big story, is the one-to-one stories of individuals who have been disenfranchised themselves, who are the end losers of what didn't work. So I went back to Youngstown, Ohio, where the votes were flipped. And I went to the people whose votes were flipped. And one by one by one, I've been interviewing them so they can tell their own stories about what happened to them. And now what I'm doing, you know, like the powers that come into hand, you go down, 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 you get these questions going, and you end up with all this electricity, and then you have to sit and up, 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 and you get the man, and the earth, the stars, and all this electricity and everything. I think a lot of what's been happening is been going up, up, up to get the big picture, the really good feeling for what happened. And so my piece, which is a small piece that I'm really working on, is to go down, down, down to the people who tried to go, and what it was like to push the carry and get this open and open.
All right. Okay.
Any other questions?
Just to follow up on this idea, Gary's idea is if you get one of these copies for free, burn it on your computer, make additional copies, and give it, hand it off.
Great. Here we go. All right. Well,
if we're mentioning the website, more than
sure. Oh, good, good one. Thanks.
Yeah. Bell of Revolution is now webcasting our national conference in Nashville, and we've got the first four pieces of audio.
So just to make sure that everybody heard that, that's velvetrevolution.us, I believe, for a great website. And tell me, and Voters Unite is another good one. I see that our time is up, so we'll wrap it up and feel free to come up and talk to us because we have a break right now. So thanks very much for being part of this.
So this is the time to have a little snack, but also David Cobb and Barbara Dudley are going to continue their debate while you're eating break food. So as soon as David comes down from upstairs, we're going to continue that here. So it was quite lively before.